From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a 15-year-old named Victor Rios was standing next to his uncle on the street. Victor had already lived a hard life. His father abandoned him before he was even born. He was often truly hungry in a family without food or money. He had been incarcerated 3 times for felonies before he turned 15 years old. And then, standing next to his uncle on that street, he heard a gunshot. His uncle fell. It might have seemed like forever waiting for an ambulance that never came. His uncle bled to death. And you can understand why young Victor gave up hope. He thought the world didn't care about him, that the system wouldn't protect him. He believed he would be dead before he turned 18. And then a teacher helped change him. In a recent TED Talk, Dr. Victor Rios said that a teacher found a way to tap into his soul. He said she understood something about young people. They're like oysters. They only open up when they're ready. And you got to be there when they're ready to open up. Today, Victor teaches college classes. He's an author. He helps educate communities about restorative practices and educational equity. And he's coming to Rochester in April as part of an event called the Restoring Rochester Conference. We're going to tell you about that coming up here. This hour, we've invited Victor to join us and to join a couple of students who recently met only President Barack Obama as part of the ongoing My Brother's Keeper initiative. That all happened in Oakland last week. We have a lot to talk about with our guest this hour as it all intertwines as we talk about educational equity, restorative practices, and more with our guests. First of all, Dr. Victor Rios is on the line with us. Great to have you. Thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Hello, Evan. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing wonderful.
And with us in studio, hello to Ruth Turner, Chief of Student Support Services and Social Emotional Learning for the Rochester City School District. Ruth, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Ruth has 2 students with her who traveled with Ruth, among others, out to Oakland last week, Jacquez Cochran and Timothy Frazier. Jacquez, 12th grade student at Young Men's Leadership Academy. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it.
I called you Timothy, but it's just Tim.
It don't really matter.
Tim's good?
Yeah.
Tim Welcome. Goes. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. Also with us in studio is Kit Miller, Executive Director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Welcome back. Always nice to see you.
You too, Evan. Thank you.
This was last week, Ruth. How did this all come together? Because there's a lot of things that we're going to tie together for you this hour, and it's really remarkable stuff. But just what happened last week, how did you get this opportunity? How did these students get this opportunity?
So Rochester is an MBK community, and that was initiated through our Mayor Lovely Warren. And part of the district work is around My Brother's Keeper initiative. So we've received a grant from New York State a couple of years back to really help us provide more student support services directly to our students. And we do that through training of students and staff and teachers around restorative practice, conflict resolution, and also building a community in which every voice is valued, every voice is heard. So we've been really privileged to do that work across the district.
Listeners might remember the name My Brother's Keeper as an initiative that goes back to the Obama presidency. It was in February 2014 that President Obama launched My Brother's Keeper as an initiative designed to address persistent opportunity gaps facing boys and young men of color and ensure that all young people can reach their full potential. And it goes on. So we're going to talk about what these students experienced in Oakland last week. And I mentioned Victor's story right off the top. I mean, Victor Rios was the kind of 15-year-old who might have lost hope, as you said. In fact, Victor, in your recent TED Talk, I couldn't help but refer to that in my introduction because I thought the story was so raw and honest. And if you don't mind, kind of take our listeners back through some of your own experience growing up and what it was like to be in your teenage years wondering if you would even live to see 20.
Yes, well, you know, already being a teenager, just for your typical young person, it's an experience that's sometimes lonely, sometimes you don't feel like you have friendships, you don't feel like you have belonging, and that's part of the natural adolescent process. But when you include poverty and trauma into that, all of a sudden you have an experience where the young person is more irrational than normal. The young person is not making the right choices. And so with me, what happens at a young age is that I'm surviving, fending for myself, figuring out where I'm going to sleep, figuring out what I'm going to eat, how to support my younger siblings. And that leads me to bad choices. And some of those bad choices put me in the system, in the juvenile justice system. I ended up going to juvie for stealing a car because I was trying to make money off the parts from that car. And in the system, I was told, we're going to teach you a lesson by some of the people in there. And it was kind of this scared, straight idea that we're going to put you with older kids, and they're going to scare you. And so when you get out, you would have learned your lesson. Well, it turned out that they put me with a 17-year-old when I was 14 in juvie, and that 17-year-old taught me about stealing faster, sportier cars. And when I left juvie, I had the skill set of stealing faster, sportier cars. I ended up stealing another car. I got caught. And so the moral of the story is that the system, instead of teaching me the right lesson, what it, in trying to punish me further, ended up teaching me the wrong lesson, and I ended up getting in trouble further. And it wasn't until this teacher interrupted this process. This teacher said, wait a minute, you know, an ounce of love can go a lot further than a pound of punishment. And so she went and convinced other teachers, let's believe in this kid, let's help him out, let's support him. And little by little, with her advocacy, I began to feel like I belonged. I began to feel like I was supported. And little by little, I started to just change my life around with those mentoring opportunities that this teacher provided me.
Listeners, daily listeners of Connections will immediately connect this conversation to our conversation yesterday afternoon, in which we talked about rates of recidivism and what we are and are not doing for people when they are released from incarceration. And Sheriff Todd Baxter was here. He said during his campaign, we have to do better, that these are our brothers and sisters who are going to be with us in society. And we are in many ways teaching them when they are released, there's not a lot for you. There's not a lot of hope for you. Just getting to a job could be difficult. Getting employers to listen to you and give you a chance could be difficult. And so, Victor, when you talk about when you were at juvie, as you say, and you learned how to essentially continue stealing or doing other things that are going to get you in trouble, I there's not a lot of avenues of hope for people. And this is so complex. I know you're talking about a teacher who helped change you, but systemically, what do you see as sort of the first step in making sure that there's more people who are in your position who can figure out that when I'm not incarcerated, I can build a life for myself, that it doesn't have to go that way?
Yeah, you know, sometimes what happens is that we, as a society, think, you know, well, people do the crime, they deserve the time. You know, people need to learn a lesson. And I agree, we all need a lesson. And I guess with this restorative justice movement in Rochester, the question becomes, what kind of lesson should we be teaching young people? Is it the kind of lesson that's going to shut them down, the kind of lesson that's going to push them out? Is it the kind of lesson that's going to debilitate their ability to survive and thrive in our society? Or is it the kind of lesson where we provide some resources, some emotional support, some care, some embracing of the individual, so that they can feel like, okay, I've paid my dues, right? I've restored the process. So I hurt someone, so I went and did my community service. I hurt someone, I went and I apologized and paid my dues for hurting them. How can I reintegrate back into the community? And so that's the big philosophical question. And it's not just a moral or philosophical question, actually, because many times, in various states across the country, we're spending $30,000, $60,000, sometimes even up to $200,000 a year to lock up one young person in jail. And when we look at the best programs out there in the nation that have to do with mentoring and guiding young people, your average pay for those is $8,000 a year. So in other words, if we reinvest, right, what we're spending on incarceration into programs where there's mentors and counselors and therapists helping young people out, that becomes a lesser cost for the taxpayer and a higher improvement in our recidivism rate. In other words, you got less people going back into the system.
Talking to Dr. Victor Rios, who's coming to Rochester as part of the Restoring Rochester Conference, and you can mark your calendar for Saturday, April 27th. It's happening at the Riverside Convention Center, so plenty of time to plan for that. Kit Miller, tell us a little bit about what's going on that day and how people can get involved.
Yes, this is the third annual conference, and last year we were at fourth annual conference. Thank you. And it was We actually filled up the space at the Holiday Inn last year, so we're over at the Convention Center this year. We're expecting almost up to 900 people to join us that day and to hear Dr. Rios and also Dr. Williams, who will be another speaker with us that day. So we hope people will jump in. It's a great opportunity. Saturday, April 27th, 8 to 3 p.m. And even the young people that are sitting in the studio with you right now, I believe, will be there. So many celebrities will be on hand.
I love that. Ruth, what are you looking forward to then?
To the conference?
Yeah.
Everything. I mean, our students are very involved in helping us plan the events. So we'll have student panel, we'll have student spoken word, we'll have some addresses from our very own students, and we also have two phenomenal speakers who are going. We're going to learn from that day. It's important to register and get your tickets early, and you can get it at www.rockrestorative.org, and it'll take you to our Eventbrite link where you can purchase your tickets. And if you purchase before April 5th, it's a discount.
All right, so there's a chance, and we'll link to that if you want to take a look on our various platforms if you want to check out the Restoring Rochester Conference that's coming up at the end of April. Let's talk to the students about what they experienced last week on these issues. I mean, you heard from Ruth Turner about how the students got involved and were selected to go out. How many total people were out there last week?
800?
About 800 or so?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is how you spend February break, and you ended up, so just tell me, Jack, Wes, and Tim, just start by telling, give me that short list of people you met. Just start with the people you met last week.
Matt Curry, President Obama.
Wait, you started with Steph Curry? Mm-hmm. You started with Steph Curry mm-hmm. over Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah.
I would have started with Barack Obama, but
I'm a big basketball fan, so, you know, I got to keep it with Steph. But Steph, Obama, Richard Sherman, Michael B. Jordan, John Legend, he performed for us. And he sings just like on like TV, and
definitely.
He just sounds crazy.
He sounds amazing, right?
Amazing,
in person, just like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
And then there's Victor Cruz, and I think that's about it.
Is that all?
You got to be all. It's probably some more.
Tim, what was it like? And forgive me for skipping over Steph Curry, but I'm a Cleveland Cavaliers fan. Mm-hmm. So what was it like? Let me start with Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. What was it like meeting President Obama?
It was type surreal to me because, like, I never met somebody that important. And then we were so up close to him. And it's like everything he said was funny. Like, he can just, like, snap and then everybody just laugh. Everybody in the audience was just laughing at him.
Did you feel like he could relate to you?
Yeah, in some ways. Some ways like that. I mean, he speaks as if he was my friend. Like, we was all in the crowd. He just, like, directly, like, talking to us and stuff like that. So that's how I feel.
What do you think, Jacquez?
It was definitely surreal. Talking to him was like, well, not talking to him, but like him and Steph had like a fireside chat in front of our face. It was definitely like a blessing being there.
What are some of the themes, some of the messages you were hearing, not just from President Obama, but from some of the other leaders you met?
It was like the black excellence type of thing. Like being in that room filled with black excellence, the theme was like we can't do it alone and we're going to do it together. The message was, what was it called? Arrive as many. And rise as one. Mm-hmm. Arrive as many, rise as one.
What did you take from it? What were some of the themes, some of the ideas you bring home?
What Obama was talking about, well, basically what My Brother's Keeper is, it's always picking up your fellows and picking up your brother after they fall down. And he was just talking about always picking them up and just keep them going with you and then bring them to success with you.
How do you apply that to maybe your circles of friends, people in your own community? Mm-hmm. How does that work? How does that sort of apply in your own life, Tim?
Because I have a couple of friends, like they might go through like depression sometimes, and I'm a good speaker, sort of, I call myself, so I'll like talk to them and things like that, and then, you know, just bring them up with me.
Okay, Jacquez?
It's kind of the same what he said, because we all can like kind of relate, but we're all different in some type of way, so he might be going through something and my other friend might be going through something. And it's not like we're scared to tell each other because we're so, feel me, like claiming that we're our brother's keeper, so we mm-hmm. live by that.
Yeah.
There's a theme that I want to ask the students about that relate to what Dr. Rios mentioned and kind of touched on in his TED Talk. So I want to ask the students about it, and then we'll bring Dr. Rios in to sort of kind of talk a little bit more about this. And that's this idea that sometimes society will say to really all young people, but it's got to be particularly stinging in maybe in different places and at different times. Well, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. And Dr. Rios mentioned in his TED Talk, that is easy to say to people. It's a lot harder to do if you literally don't have boots or bootstraps.
Right.
And but at the same time, when you hear President Obama Steph Curry, John Legend, and they're telling you, hey, link arms, help each other out, but realize your own potential. I think there's this sort of unfortunate political right-left divide, guys, where it's like conservatives think, hey, look, if this person can do it, I've literally heard people say, well, if LeBron James can do it, I'm going, yeah, there's lots of LeBron James. But people say that. Whereas on the left, you hear people say, look, the deck is stacked too far against people. Mm. But what we don't want is people giving up hope while creating a more fair system. Do you feel like you can pull yourself up and succeed in society right now, Tim?
Yes, sir.
You do?
Despite all the hate against blacks, I feel like I can pull myself up.
You feel like you're going to make your own future, you're going to be successful?
Yes, sir.
How do you feel, Jack Wes?
I'm definitely confident. I know I have a God that I serve that's beyond anything that anybody can make for me. And my faith in him is so strong that I know I'm going to make it.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add to that. I think what our two students are talking about is this belief in self. But I think we also acknowledge that it takes a community, it takes a village for any of us to succeed as individuals. So I just want to clarify, oftentimes
Absolutely.
We talk about meritocracy and it's a myth. Okay, I think that primarily in African-American communities, the deck is stacked against individuals, whether it's individuals living in poverty, whether it's racism, sexism. So I think to have the expectation that an individual can just pull themselves up from the bootstrap is a myth, that it takes a village, it takes a community of support. And if we look at any successful person, they will tell you, just like Dr. Rios, well, I made it because a teacher, believed in me, or I had parents who helped mm-hmm. me, or I had a community that stood behind me. Even these two gentlemen who are here today are here because they have a village behind them. So I just want to make it very clear, because I'm not sure there was a clear understanding of your question, that none of us make it by ourselves. We don't live in isolation. We are interconnected as human beings, and we need each other to succeed. And that's the whole idea of My Brother's Keeper, is that you're not only responsible for yourself, but you're responsible for your community mm-hmm. and to rise up with your community and not forget your community behind because you've achieved a level of success.
I think Dr. Rios will have a lot to say on that subject. His TED Talk has a lot to say, a very popular one that you can find online. Go ahead, Dr. Rios.
Thanks. Yeah, so I mean, it's very eloquent, very beautifully put by the young people. I just admire their resilience and their grit, because the myth is, right, that poor people, for example, if we're talking about poor people or young urban people or whatever labels we have, right, but young people that are facing adversity, the myth is that, oh, this person might have not made it, might not have a job or a good education because they're lazy. This person, might have not made it, have a good job or good education because they didn't try hard enough. That's the myth. But if you go out into working class communities and poor communities, you're going to find 90% of the people, right, that are hardworking. One thing you can be guaranteed about the working class is that they learn a hard work ethic. And so in my 10 years of studying young people that get in trouble with the law, that get in trouble at school, what I found is that internally in their mind, and in the way they communicate, they are dreaming about making it. They are dreaming about going to college. They are dreaming of becoming professionals. None of them, or very few of them actually, will say, hey, when I grow up, I want to be in prison. You rarely hear that. I mean, it's just some kid trying to be tough that might say that. Most of the time, right, they use the other P word, which is when I grow up, I want to be a professional, right? And not when I grow up, I want to go to prison. But our sense of young people that are caught up in trouble in school or caught up in trouble with law enforcement is that, oh, they must be wanting to find that trouble. And so when we shift our perspective of them and say, wait a minute, let's meet them where they're at. They want to be professionals. They believe in themselves. You heard these two young men saying, hey, I believe I can make it despite all these adversities I'm facing. Then how can we provide them the adequate resources to make it? And what I've found is that sometimes, you can provide someone a very minimal resource, like, for example, a $12 an hour, $14 an hour job just to keep them sustaining, right, for 10 hours a week. And before you know it, that little bit of money is what makes the difference between them and other peers who don't have that job opportunity. And this is real. I mean, even though the unemployment rate is low compared to 10 years ago for all Americans, young people of color, particularly young males of color, still have three times the unemployment rate of your average American. That goes to say that there is still a gap in the labor market in terms of discriminating against our young people, and there's still a gap in terms of opportunities. So that opportunity gap, the minute we start to bridge it and provide those resources, and sometimes those resources, like I said, it doesn't take a whole lot. You know, young people go from being just dreamers to also being strivers. And the difference between a dreamer and a striver is that the striver actually takes the day-to-day steps to make it to the next level, to succeed, to become a professional. And they need adequate, positive adults in their lives to turn them from dreamers to strivers. One such adult, for example, could be someone at school that, instead of being a security officer that walks them to a detention room when they get in trouble, we have a success coach, right, that is trained when they're getting in trouble to teach them conflict resolution, to do restorative justice circles with them. And instead of locking them up in some detention room or kicking them out of school or the classroom, they're actually working with them, teaching them life skills to deal with conflict in their day-to-day lives.
Jacquez and Tim, you guys see people circling up in your school? You circle up?
Yes, sir.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. We lead them. We lead the circles.
All right, so this has been one of the really rewarding parts of conversations about restorative practices on this program for several years now, is my understanding and learning about circling up, seeing sort of it bear fruit in different ways. So describe it for me. I want to ask the students to describe it. So,
all right, so
what happens? What's it look like?
All right, so in our circle, it's like a lot of shy people and people that don't speak out. So what we do is we do a lot of activities sometimes, and like, it's this game called Where My People At. It's basically one person get in the middle, say, Where My People At? And then they say, Where My People At that's wearing green or something like that? And then everybody stand up and run to different seats and like that. And that's really just getting everybody out their seats and getting them out the shyness and stuff like that, and just allowing them to be more open with themselves.
And ultimately, what is the goal of circling up, Tim? If you're successful, what happens in a circle?
I mean, you're speaking out against your problems. Like, you just letting everybody know, letting your village know, like Ms. Ruth said, know your problems, and finding ways to discuss it and get rid of it.
Okay. How would you describe it? The goal and how it functions?
The conflict would be over. I led a circle, I think, last year. It was with full adults. I led a circle with full adults. It was me, and there was like a couple classrooms in our school, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was like four or five circles. I led one, Tim led one, my friend Joe, and, you know, Raphael led them. And it was like hearing their side of the story from, like, kids' side of the story in a circle. And it's like the conflict, we're all trying to get to one goal, but they have different conflicts than we have, and we don't see their point of view, and they don't see ours. So getting that feedback from them and then giving our type of import into the problem was definitely great. And a lot of solutions came about that this year. The school, our environment at leadership is so different. Mm-hmm. It's so different.
Why do you think it's different?
The culture around the school. Leadership, they brought a lot of African Americans in the building. Ms. Brown on the third floor, she's amazing. Ms. Lewis is amazing. Our security guards are like us. Feel me? So it's not like it's not no beef. Kind of like it's not no beef in the in our school.
No, I say, hold on. You got to define the term then. When you say it's not no beef, what do you mean?
I mean, we all have that one teacher. You know, it's like you go in there, it's beef. Feel me? Like, it's already like tension in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So when we walking in the hallways, we don't have a reason to go beef with that teacher, because we're getting slap ups from our teachers. We're gonna slap it from hugs from our teachers. It doesn't like
the guards.
Yeah, it's like not home, but it's like it's more warming than other years. When mm-hmm. it seemed like people in the hallways were trying to come get us.
So when people have problems with each other in a culture like you're describing, mm-hmm. they're more likely to settle the conflict without it getting
definitely
physical.
Definitely.
Definitely.
What class was it? We have a military science, and I would be in military science last year. And by that time, I was circle certified, basically the leader circle. And I would get called out of that class to come up to the third floor with the eighth graders or seventh graders who were having a problem and had got removed from class. And I talked with them. So it wasn't no physical. We barely have fights in leadership now. So last year, I came up there in the third floor, you know, talked to them and led a circle, asked questions, why, what happened, stuff like that, and actually getting them to talk. And the problem could be so little and they wouldn't even notice because of the questions that we ask and the tying it together.
But, Jaguar, this is it's not easy to do that, though.
No, it's not.
I mean, you're describing, you go up to the third floor, you get them to circle up, you see that the problems were small. And to describe it in a sentence sounds simple. But when people are feeling emotionally heated to the point where they could be violent with each other, it is not easy to get them to see that we're not that different. Mm. Here's why this person acted this way. Even if I don't agree, I understand it. I want them to. How did you do that? How do you do that?
It was like them seeing themselves inside me. So basically, in eighth grade, I wasn't the best, but I wasn't like for me. So it was like I could tell them that I related to them and tell them an example of my story in eighth grade and why me and this kid got into it or something like that. And they can relate to me. They don't want to talk to the ISS teacher who just making them write on a piece of paper. It's like a connection. They want to open up to me more than they want to open up to another.
Does it take some time to get people to open up a little bit?
Kind of question. I ask questions, talk about what I did or something like that. Maybe they want to talk to me first. And it could take some time, but we got time.
Have you seen people... You know, I don't know if they're shaking hands or hugging, but when they're close to coming to blows with each other, you've seen people walk away calm? Much,
of course.
Absolutely.
Plenty of times. The tension, and like, you can feel the tension when they come in, and by the time they leave, the tension, it'd be gone.
Tim, you want to add to that? Just how you make that happen?
Yeah. So I think it was like a month ago, we had like another circle, and these two students got into it, like not really like fist fight, but it's like close to that point.
Yep.
Because we was having like a debate, and I guess like the blacks and the police got into it, like the debate between them two. And so each time I try to cheer somebody up or like cheer, like calm the situation down, what I do is like I talk to them, and by the end I make them shake hands and then give each other a smile. Like they got to give each other a smile. Just to show that you're good. And then I just make them go back and just sit on like that. That's what I do though.
Sometimes it's hard to look at somebody in the eye and smile.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Sometimes you don't want to.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I like that technique. Ruth, how do you feel hearing them describe? Victor, why don't you jump in first, and then I can't wait to hear what Ruth thinks hearing these students describe it.
Yeah, the larger picture here is to keep in mind, folks, is that while it sounds real simple, right, it sounds like, oh, okay, well, you know, people are just talking to each other, people are resolving conflict. It sounds really simple, but there's a lot at stake here. What's at stake here is that we're actually reversing what we call the school-to-prison pipeline.
Right.
So for the last 40 or 50 years in America, right, we got so harsh and so hard on crime and school discipline that we started to kick kids out of school left and right and just suspend them. And the suspension rates for black children, in particular black males, was astronomical all over America. And these children would end up on the street. And when they ended up on the street, they ended up getting picked up by the police, and then they got on probation, or they went to juvie, or they went to camp, or they went to jail when they got older. And what happened was that this whole generation of young black men were getting caught up in the criminal justice system, all beginning with some simple school discipline that could have been addressed the way these young men are addressing the problems today. So this is not just, right, people talking, right? What's at stake here is young people being able to prevent entering the criminal justice system and actually build life skills for themselves so that they can be successful later on in life. Mm.
Ruth, what do you make of what you heard from the students?
That's exactly what we trained them to do. Part of the training our youth, which we call our ROC responders, students, is training them to understand the school-to-prison pipeline, helping them understand how the system works, right, and what are the better alternatives. So they make it sound easy because when you're in a culture of circling up, it does become routine. It becomes just as a culture of fighting and violence. So that school has been, for the last couple of years, really training and implementing restorative practice. So when there's a conflict and they say circle up, individuals know what to expect. And what's powerful is that it's the first time that most students get to tell their side of the story. Because oftentimes, if you get into argument or fight, you get suspended, you get sent to the principal's office. But it's a time where the whole community is together and everybody gets to hear each other's side of the story. And that doesn't necessarily mean agreement, but it brings great understanding. So in schools in which restorative practice has become a part of the culture, it does sound fairly easy to say, okay, you guys are about to go to Blows. Go, you know, to this and this room, and we're going to circle up. Individuals know what to expect. They know that their side is going to get hurt, and they also know what needs to happen in order to repair the harm that's been done to that particular community. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful to see it in action. It's amazing when we've moved on to training students to see that the students get it a lot quicker than the adults, which is very interesting.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, they're really excited. They're willing to give their time and the effort. It's almost like the light bulb has gone on, and they see a better way of addressing and dealing with conflict. But more than that, also intentionally building community before conflict starts. So one of the things that Tim described was Where My People At, which is an activity to help build community, to get people to know each other and see some commonality that they have amongst each other. And when you build a community, you're less likely to harm each other. And when you harm each other, you're quicker to amend and repair the harm that's done.
Definitely. And it's like a system. You know, we're facing a system any day. So the system that we have is basically has to be stronger than the system that we're fighting.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Ruth, was a couple of years ago, we talked about really expanding just how much restorative practices, circling up, and sort of related approaches are used in RCSD. How widespread is it now?
So we're still a very small group of folks. Of course, you know, funding restrictions. So we have about 38 schools that are participating. It's a lot of work for my team, a whole district. But more than the district, we're also impacting communities. So we work with faith-based communities. We work with our partners. We work with individuals in juvenile detention center, because what we want our students to know is that we want this to be coming among the community, not just school, so that when they go to after-school rec, they understand what circling up means. They understand what community building circles are and how we learn to live well in community. So that's always a challenge, but we are optimistic because this is the first time that we've had 40% decrease in suspension, and largely due to our restorative practice efforts and really moving away from being punitive to really looking at relationships and how harm is done to relationship and how we can build community intentionally, which has made a huge difference in the way we interact with our students and the way our students interact with us.
Ruth, are you hearing from other schools in RCSD that don't use restorative practices, that don't circle up, that want to do more of that?
Yeah, there's. I mean, everybody is not a believer. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that they are, right? But the evidence is overwhelming, right? So what is good for students is good for us, and we need to move beyond those systems in which we're comfortable, because adults, we love control and power. It's really hard to give up that control and power, but what we do is that we empower our students to make a demand of the system. So it's not what I'm comfortable with, what is best for them, right? And what kind of environment are they going to grow up? Because these skills that our students are learning is going to take them throughout their life, right? It's going to take them how to function in the workforce, how to deal with your family members, how to deal with community partners, how to deal with the police. So these are lifelong skills, and it's the right thing to do, so we're determined to do so. But we have overwhelming demand from schools in which they are engaging in restorative practice, and it's been very successful in terms of, and there's so much that goes with it. You know, we do a lot of work around teacher resiliency. It's challenging to teach, right? It really is. And we also understand that in order for us to pour out to our students, somebody has to pour into us. So our restorative practice is so much beyond just circles, but we also look at teacher wellness, right? How do we begin to restore ourselves so that we can take better care of our students and be better teachers and better educators?
I just want to say one of the things that has been important to me also is to say that there were schools in this community 5 or 10 years ago, before a larger effort was undertaken, that went far down a restorative journey. But when support wasn't maintained for that journey, they slipped back. So one of the things I really want to say is that because this is anti-systemic work in a lot of ways, both in relation to institutional racism and also just dynamics around the education system as a whole, I think it's critical that we keep the pressure up. And while this is systems change work, and it's a multi-year effort, and it needs to be supported, I also want to, you know, celebrate that the restorative work now is happening in the courts here. I'm going to be in Groveland Prison this Friday doing a restorative conversation in terms of community building with people in the community who are talking to men who are soon to be released back up into Rochester. We need to do this work across the board. Suburban districts now are picking it up. So for me, this is really an important part of our work as a community trying to deal with our legacy of racism and hypersegregation. I mean, this is important work that needs to be done everywhere.
All right, we're going to take a short respite, and we're going to right back to let you know if you want to attend the Restoring Rochester Conference. That's Saturday, April 27th. You just heard Kit Miller, the executive director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, Ruth Turner, the chief of student support services and social emotional learning for the Rochester City School District, Jacquez Cochran and Tim Frazier, our 12th grade students at Young Men's Leadership Academy, and on the line with us is Dr. Victor Rios, who is an author, a social justice scholar, and he's going to be coming to Rochester as part of the conference on April 27th. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, did you hear recently that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas questioned the premise of Times v. Sullivan, a landmark case that helped set the boundaries for how we consider libel? And if that changes, what does it mean for journalists? What journalists can expect to happen when they print stories, when they print news. A conversation about Times v. Sullivan going forward Wednesday. We continue on Connections right here on WXXI and member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're just talking with Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute about, you know, I looked at Ruth Turner when she mentioned that often when students circle up and kind of engage in these restorative practices, as opposed to what a lot of listeners may be more familiar with, just firmer discipline, I don't want to say firmer, but discipline that is more traditional, detention, suspension, etc., that the student, Ruth is saying that the students often get this earlier than the adults do, quicker than the adults do. And Kit, Kit was making a point there that I want to pick up on. Go ahead, Kit.
Well, you were noticing that both the young men sitting with us kind of lit up when Ruth, you know, celebrated that students grab hold of this work faster sometimes than adults do. And my point was that because it's an opportunity for them to have power in their world. And people that don't have power in systems tend to have a sharper gaze, and they understand the systems better than the people for whom the systems are served to set and for whom they're set up. You don't notice systems at work unless they're not working on your behalf. We have a critical gaze that gets developed as a young person, as a person of color, on these systems that people who are coming out of dominant culture don't have a chance to see. So that's why that's part of why this work is so very critical.
And Jacquez, you want to add to that, just that question of power and the feeling that students have with the restorative practices?
Yes, it's like the teachers that have most of the power, basically, because that's who we're not with the principals who have power. We're not with the assistant principal. We're with the teachers all day. And they feel as if they can come at us any type of way. So when I led that circle, and it was like me doing the facilitating, me doing the talking, a lot of them were like acting like the kids in class. Their head was down, or they was playing fidgeting with their hands. It's kind of weird.
What did you make of that?
I took advantage of it. I got my points out. My friend, you know, we talked at the lunch table about why I just got kicked out of class. So I took advantage of that and telling them their side of the story, them explaining to me what they were thinking. And then they say, like, maybe, like, they had a problem at home or it got dragged to work or something. But I'm guaranteeing that their problems at home is not guaranteed. It's guaranteed not, like, worse than the problem that we're facing in our community.
Yeah, Jacquez, Tim, when you circle up, there's a stereotype that boys and men open up less or less, you know, sort of powerfully. Does that start to change? Do you see this as an opportunity, especially for boys and men, to open up in ways that maybe stereotypically they're not as used to? Tim?
Yeah, like the little seventh graders and eighth graders, they're like really, really quiet. And like during the circles, we tend to see that they're like actually really loud now, and they just like laugh, play around with each other and stuff like that. And one thing I think that really changed them out is where my people are at the game. So I think really all schools should try to practice that one game to open up to people.
You see boys and men opening up more?
Yeah, it's like building a trust, because you know, if you're a man and you don't trust, or young man, I'm not a man yet, but seeing as like, if I don't trust him or I don't know that young man, I won't tell him my problem. But if Tim is right here, of course, since I trust him, I can tell him whatever I need to, and we can express it like that. But men, like boys and men not opening up is a way that like we were raised, or the way that you like you should be as a man, the principle as a man, you shouldn't be open, or you shouldn't open up to anybody like that. So breaking that policy, or whatever you want to call it. It has been big.
Men have feelings. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Dr. Victor Rios, I don't want to sort of pose a question and make it seem like, well, if you only had restorative practices and circling up when you were growing up, that your childhood would have looked different. I mean, you certainly had a lot of challenges that you describe in your TED Talk, and you know, and I really feel for that. But do you think in your own mind that things might have gone differently at different times in your childhood if circling up was more a thing when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, what happens in schools is that more and more teachers are playing the role of being not just an educator, but also a social worker, a therapist, a hero, a shiro, a healer. And what happens with children that come into the system at a young age with trauma and with stress and with poverty and with need, is that the only person, the only real kind of adult sometimes that could potentially provide them some guidance, some restoration in their life, could be that educator. So if there were, or their peers, right, but facilitated by an educator, if there were those circles when I was little, I mean, it would have started the process of helping me learn to heal, because this is restorative justice. At the end of the day, it's about healing communities and it's about healing individuals. And when you start that process of healing, you start to see people open up, people improve relationships, and then young people are ready to learn. So when you teach to the heart, the mind will follow. And a lot of teachers, I would say the majority of teachers, understand this. They want to teach to the heart, right, and then focus on the academics. But sometimes we have test scores we're relying on. We have big tests coming up. We have college, you know, readiness. We got math to teach them, and teachers get caught up in that world because that's what the system expects, that they teach kids, you know, the arithmetic. They teach kids the literature. And in that pressure to teach kids the arithmetic and the literature, sometimes, you know, the teacher's not able to work with them on the life skills, on the healing part. But teachers have that purpose. I mean, I cannot think of any other profession where someone signs up for maybe 20% less pay than their academic credentials, an average of 6 years of college education for educators, could pay them in an open labor market besides education. And so folks sign up to be teachers because it's in their heart to help others. And so when we provide those educators the right resources and the time for them to implement these circles, for the time for them to teach young people life skills and connect to them emotionally, then we start to see the difference in terms of young people being able to open up and be ready to learn. Because we now know, neuroscientists are finding that the processes in the brain connected to learning are inextricably connected to the processes in the brain related to emotion. In other words, I can't learn if my emotional state is not balanced and stable. It's just cognitively, right, at a physiological level, I just can't learn. And so therefore, as educators, right, from when children are very young, we could implement these strategies, the circles. It sounds real simple, right? You know, where's my people at? But you know what? As simple as it sounds, what that is saying, hey, I got your back. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're my people. Mm-hmm. Hey, in this classroom today, we're going to connect and be one community and a safe haven for you, regardless of what's going on outside in that real world. Because in this school, in this classroom, we love you. You belong here, and we're going to do whatever it takes for you to be prepared to learn.
And we need to put that in place in all schools. You know, we know from the school shootings that are happening nationally, which are not happening in urban schools, they're happening in suburban spaces, that it's kids who have been alienated and who don't feel that they belong, who don't feel that they're loved, who are the ones who are doing tremendous damage. So, you know, I want to just, this is something that all kids need.
Yeah, I thought about going in this direction, and I want to be careful because I don't want to necessarily say bullying causes school shootings, you know, but because it's complex, and I don't want to just blame victims of school shootings either. I want to be very, very careful. But I am curious to know if this kind of practice will reduce bullying in school settings. You know, it, because unfortunately, I don't know that you can ever fully remove that the notion of bullying from every school at all times. But are we less likely, Ruth, are we less likely to see pervasive bullying in schools if we have restorative practices and these approaches?
Absolutely. Because what happens is not the school community gets to know each other. So oftentimes, you know, when bullying occurs because individuals mistrust each other, dislike each other, there's differences, or there's perceived that, you know, individuals picking on somebody who's weaker than them, you are less likely to harm someone you know. And you're definitely less likely to harm someone you care about intentionally. So we've seen the complete change in behavior, even when some of our students who've been trained sort of revert back to that, they quickly say, you know, my bad, I apologize, I didn't mean that, right? Because they realize that that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to alienate somebody else. You know, it's not acceptable to pick on somebody else, especially if you're your brother's keeper. So that's the one thing we tell them, is like, are you your brother's keeper? And if you say you are, this is how you show you're your brother's keeper. So it's a high level of accountability. And when we notice incidents in which there is bullying occurring, because it occurs everywhere, when you bring individuals in that community together and begin to address it, that's a high level of accountability. So an individual begin to share about how they feel, because they don't have a friend, or how they feel because, you know, they're not in the in crowd and somebody's picking them at lunch, we see that students begin to understand the impact that that has on the individual, and they're more likely to change their behavior. So we've absolutely seen a decrease in disrespect. I prefer to disrespect versus bullying. We've seen incidents where there's a decrease in violence, a decrease in disrespect, and we've seen it where students correct themselves, which is very important. It's a lifelong skill that you're going to make mistakes, right? Just like as adults, we make mistakes. And what we've seen is that those students will correct themselves and come back and apologize to one another, right? And say, you know, I shouldn't have done that, or I was wrong in doing that. So yeah, we've definitely, I'll let them speak to that too. We've definitely seen incidents where the bullying has decreased significantly.
Tim, Jacques, you agree?
Yeah,
I agree. Strongly agree.
Like this, all right, so for example, I say, where my people had to have on Vans, right? And the bully and the guy that's getting bullied, they both have on Vans. They both get up, they both move, they're going to share a laugh. Like, they're the only two people up, they're going to share a laugh. So, like, that's just bringing people closer together.
Okay. Jacques?
With the bullying, it's like, like she said, it's like the culture around a bully. So I guess the bully woke up on the wrong side of bed or something like that. But him coming into a culture where if he bully another kid that is known has a strong, not a strong support system, but like somebody has his back or something like that, but somebody also has the bully back, him having like the chance to bully him won't happen because in school, you're never alone. Like, you can't be alone in school. So if everybody has your back, where do he have the opportunity to bully you or disrespect you?
So what he's talking about is specifically training bystanders. So those are the individuals who witness a bullying behavior and have the power to either grab that individual and say, hey, let's go, or stand up for them. So one of the things that we train the youth is that, you know, the bystander is the most powerful individual to be able to intervene and stop a bullying behavior. So that's what he's referring to, is that when you see that happen, he's like, come on, man, let's go to class. You know, I got your back. And then people begin to see you're not going to join in the bullying behavior, but you're actually going to stand up for a person in a non-threatening way. So that are some of the things that we train through our restorative practice.
Powerful. And before we lose the hour, I want to ask Dr. Rios to put a fine point on something here. A lot of what we've been talking about is an approach in a school setting. And when you talk about the so-called school-to-prison pipeline, we're not just talking about school, we're not just talking about graduation rates, we're talking about helping people build lives, you know. And do you think, Dr. Rios, that the habits that people build, you know, when they talk about a culture of circling up, they know to do it. Like, that's just what happens. It becomes a default. When you're out of that school and you're, you know, living your life, does that culture impact you in a way that will also be beneficial?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, what we're talking about is changing society, is changing culture at a national, even global level. What we're talking about is reframing who we're raising as a society, as a generation. So, for example, going back to the bullying, all right, you could have a school with 4 security guards searching for bullies, and then you could have another school with 600 students that learn to be proactive bystanders, meaning when they see those 600 kids all learn to identify disrespectful or bullying behavior, and they nip it in the bud, they say, oh, excuse me, you're not allowed to call girls the B word because it causes harm to not just this woman, but all women in our society. So please don't use that language. And you got a whole squad of kids willing to stand up against a kid using the B word towards a girl. And all of a sudden, you've changed an entire school culture. And these kids grow up and they go into politics and they learn as politicians not to be bullies. They go into making films, right? Producing media. They learn not to produce media that's going to perpetuate stereotypes and teach us to be more aggressive or violent as a society. They go into leadership, and they actually teach us how to be better global leaders, because now, right, those life skills they learn as youngsters are applied in the real world, and then we start to see the world become a more peaceful, more progressive place where everyone feels included, no matter what background of class, of race, of gender they come from.
You can meet Dr. Victor Rios on Saturday, April 27th at the Restoring Rochester Conference. Kit Miller, where to get signed up for that?
Please go check out www.rockrestorative.org. And don't forget, your tickets before April 5th are cheaper than they are after.
Rockrestorative.org. Dr. Rios, we'll see you in Rochester in April. Thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Gracias.
Our thanks to the students from Young Men's Leadership Academy, Jacquez Cochran, Tim Frazier.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
So
we appreciate you. Thank you very much. Ruth Turner from RCSD, always good to talk to you. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute. Thank you, Kit.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member-Supported Public Radio.